Here we go. Next speaker this afternoon is Dr. Rick Ellion. Rick is currently the Director of Clinical Research at Whitman Walker Health in Washington, D.C., and Associate Professor of Clinical Medicine at George Washington University School of Medicine. He is a member of the CDC Advisory Board on PrEP and Community Health Centers. Rick has been an active member in HIV care and research since 1985 and has been leading the development of novel prevention strategies. And with great pleasure, I introduce you to Dr. Rick Ellion.
Well, welcome to Washington, everybody. How many of you are from Washington? Oh, very well represented by our native sons and daughters. So I guess you realize that you are in the capital of the United States, but also the capital of HIV prevalence. The rate of HIV, the prevalence of HIV in Washington, D.C. is about 3%. Our clinic handles about 3,000 HIV patients, probably about a quarter of the epidemic in the district. And my thoughts about HIV have been very much shaped by, I've been active treating HIV for 25 years, and that's given me a good feel for treatment. But I think my biggest understanding about prevention is from our STD program. We run an STD clinic that's well known in the city. Probably some of you may have even been there at times, hopefully to volunteer, but maybe to partake as consumers. And we are open to volunteers, so any of you who are healthcare providers, we welcome your contributions. But we take care of about 70 men and women a week. And we have about 25% of what we call them repeat customers. And when we realize that we have so many people who come back and come back and come back, clearly the messages of sexual education aren't necessarily cerebral. And we need to figure out other strategies. And that's where our sort of interest in medications came along. We didn't get to see each other's slides before we began. And Ken stole 95% of my slides because I borrowed them from him to begin with. So I'll try not to be redundant and focus most of my time on our experience of what we think issues are around implementation. And then I'll let Ron deal with some of the policy issues. That's what you're going to talk about. Yes. And then Ron will deal with some of the policy issues, and then we'll try and deal with stuff in the Q&A. Well, those are my disclosures. I do a lot of research, so I'm doing research with all of these companies. So I have to acknowledge them first. Okay. So this is just going that if we were doing a very good job in prevention, we wouldn't have an 8% incidence. We see these numbers increasing over time, and it makes one wonder if it's very clear that we've done a lot of good with our prevention efforts. Education has been an incredibly powerful thing. The impact of public health education and messaging and has been extraordinarily important for the HIV community. But at the same time, it hasn't taken us to the finish line. And we still have a number of patients who are still developing new infections despite our educational messages. And these new infections are not spread equally among the United States population. This impacts African Americans more so than Caucasians. In Washington, D.C., if you're between 20 and 45 and you're a black man, you have a 20% rate of being HIV positive. If you're in Washington, D.C., and you're between 20 and 45, that you have a 60% of you have been in prison at some time in the last 5 years, compared to about 5 or 7% among the Caucasian population. So very different epidemics within the different populations, and it's unclear that one would necessarily choose the same strategies for each group. This gives you a feeling for a case of somebody who comes into our clinic, A.B., an 18-year-old Caucasian male. He's a college student who's single, uses drugs on the weekends. He's a infrequent user of crystal meth. Normally we have longer times. I stole a joke from Ken's colleague who did the stuff on Manhunt at, I guess it was IAS, where he had people who were on their on Manhunt in the room, and you could see the conversations going about my presentation about how boring is it, can't we just meet later, and then you see the two people leaving the room to go hook up. The era of sexual liaisons has changed radically. And I quote the person who I think was from Ken's site, or was from Los Angeles, actually, I believe it was the site when he presented, which is that Manhunt currently has close to, I think it's 8,000 new people a day coming on. And how many of you do not know what Manhunt is? Okay, we'll have a tutorial later for you all, but it's basically an online way to meet new friends. And what you'd want to do with these new friends is more than just play words with friends. You do other things. So we'll leave it at that. But anyway, so he's obsessed with the internet as a way to fantasize about the many men. And he spends, in the average amount of time that people who are on men, I think it's about 2 hours, a little under 2 hours a day that people will spend on online. He has 1 to 2 partners each month that he meets. He uses drugs with them about half the time. And he's not sure if he would want to do PrEP. And he asks you, what would you recommend? So, the interest among patients, as Ken pointed out in his study, is increasing. I'm going to show you a group of interest amongst providers, patients and then providers. This was data presented, oh, they're losing the bottom of the slide, in PrEP among HIV-negative patients seen at an STI clinic in Chicago. About 360 patients, and you see a great interest in people. 83% would take a pill for PrEP. 80% of them would be willing to do an hour before sex. There wasn't any data on what would happen after sex, though clearly the enthusiasm for that starts to wane. And lower education levels had a fivefold impact on people who were less interested in this. So to some degree, this is showing a greater interest level for educated patients than non-educated patients. Of course, this is initially before we rolled out some of the efforts. When we look at providers, this was a study presented at the European AIDS conference about a month, 2 weeks ago, looking at 190 physicians, more or less, in Los Angeles, who carried at least a 20 HIV patient caseload. You could see here that the largest group of things that people were worried about was the development of resistance. The second largest group was patient non-compliance. And the third largest group would lead to increased risk behavior. These groups are almost equally sized. And one of the things I hear a lot from providers about this is this issue about increased risk exposures. There's a big concern about it being an enabling behavior, that we have a very clear method of prevention for HIV, and if we're going to give PrEP, are we going to be unleashing, quote-unquote, a barrage of different sexual behaviors. That remains to be seen. I think the data that Ken presented showed that it wasn't seen, that in patients who had unprotected anal intercourse, the rates didn't go up in those people on the study, but it was in the context of a clinical trial. And in clinical trial, you usually put your best and brightest patients in those studies, and it's not the same as the people who necessarily use these kind of things. And so it remains to be seen about that. The other piece about the sexual information from IPREX is that if you remember that IPREX showed that about 80 or 90% of the patients said that they took their meds religiously, and when you measured the blood, about half of them were doing that. So there was about a 40 or 50% of not reporting truthfully in the study, and it's unclear if those unprotected anal intercourse comments are equally of the same veracity or not. So this is a big issue, because if we think, if Ken's data showed that, not Ken's data, but other data about the cost benefit showed up, there's a 4.5 increase incidence in partners. I don't know exactly what that would mean, but it sounds like about 2 to 3 more partners in a year, if that, would be enough to destabilize this. Then these numbers start to change. And so that's where the equation gets a little sticky as to what the benefit between of a technology is going to be and what impact that'll have on human behavior. We just don't have that data yet. When you look at the providers again and you ask them what kind of things they would want to do first, the first one is to make sure that everybody's negative. Well, there's problems with making sure that everybody's negative, in that there's the window period when people aren't antibody positive. The rapid tests will detect in a period of about a month, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, leaving that window. The test that will tell you if someone's been exposed in a 3-day period costs about $150. It's not amenable. It's available. It's an excellent test, but it's not available for community health centers because it's too expensive. So we really are limited by the rapid test, so we can't really do that. This issue about testing for acute infection, whether providers would be knowledgeable to recognize that as an important issue. You don't want to be giving PrEP to someone you think has the flu and in fact has acute HIV seroconversion syndrome. I think understanding the patient's risk exposure, and, you know, in D.C. we don't like to talk about risk groups anymore. I don't think it's that different in other parts of the country. We really talk about behaviors. And so can we help educate providers as to understanding about exposures, not risk groups, getting away from the stigmatization of whether you're straight, gay, bisexual, but what's your sexual exposure? Who do you have sex with? Screening for hepatitis B would be an important issue, and then obviously this would increase the issue of STIs. And so some of these things, which I'm going to get to at the very end, start to suggest where would you nest such services? How would you implement these services, and what kind of programs would you put them in? This was information that Ken gave already, just going along the efficacy, so I'll skip this, other than to say that amongst people who take this regularly, it's very, very efficacious. Amongst people who don't take it very regularly, it's not so efficacious. And so the question is, can we find more regimens that will be friendly enough? And I don't think that any of us feel very comfortable that the daily regimens that might come out in the first quarter of this year will be the kind of regimens that we think are going to lead to widespread adherence. There'll be certain patients that, of course, will be appropriate for, but on a population basis, anything that's required every day, I think all of us have some concerns. And so that's one of the challenges from an implementation point that lies ahead as well. Ken talked about the data about treatment as prevention, so I'm not going to talk about this so much. I'm going to just present this slide a little bit just to show that there was a little bit initially whether we, in terms of cost, if maybe we could use just tenofovir alone and not tenofovir and FTC. And this is data showing in a SHIV model with chemoprophylaxis that you had a lot better protection with combined regimens than you did with individual regimens. And so the ability to save costs, perhaps with just tenofovir, may not be true. There was other studies, I think, in the partner's prep, you can see that tenofovir and tenofovir FTC were almost similar for the number of infections, statistically very similar, but there were differences, a 9% difference in the reduction, and maybe in a larger study that had more infections, you'd see a difference. But I think there's a growing concern that tenofovir alone may not be applicable in terms of oral. With microbicides, I think it's a different situation, and I'd be curious to ask Ken's opinion on that when we get into the Q&A stuff. So for women, it's another question altogether. I didn't even remember that this was just a session for MSM because I just was thinking of the community we see in D.C., but clearly this is a relevant issue for women. Juanita would be the seronegative partner of JW. JW doesn't want to start treatment. It's easy if JW wants to start because HPTN052 is a no-brainer in terms of transmitting that. But HPTN052 raises a question that is HIV now going to become what do I do for my community, not just for myself? The merits of taking HIV treatment, HPTN052, globalized to a disease of transmission, not just an individual's choice for themselves. And whether individuals in all cities are ready to make that leap is an open question. In San Francisco, where 90% of the population is HIV positive, is on ARVs, you have a clear answer to that. But I don't think you have that same kind of answer throughout other cities in the United States. And so time will tell. So the answer is for what we would tell her to do is we're not sure. We don't know if she'd be better off taking a microbicide, if she'd be better off taking an oral medication. The VOICES study suggests that that wasn't a good thing for her to do if she took tenofovir alone. Maybe tenofovir FTC would be okay, but we wouldn't have an answer for her just yet. And this we talked about. One of the issues, as we related before, is this question about adherence. And I think this is going to be critically important because we're already talking about a population of people who demonstrated that as far as condoms go, they're not adherent. It doesn't mean to say that people who don't want to use condoms can't be adherent to oral medications because many of us have had the choice about using condoms or taking a pill in relationship to sexual activity, and we sometimes choose one but not choose the other. It doesn't mean you can't be a person who does that. So this data just shows that if you will use and if you've got drug detection, you have a very, very low rate of infection. Ken covered that. I think, well, this is a little bit different than you covered. This is a little different. So this was an internet survey looking at about 1,200 patients in San Francisco where 70% had heard of PrEP post-IPREX. 70% they'd be interested in. This was the data that Ken did present already. But the point here is that if the pill is 44% effective in preventing HIV, how would this affect your use of condoms? Because clearly one of the issues is going to be that there'll still be some rates perhaps of infection. And are we going to sell oral protection as something that you no longer need to use condoms? In IPREX, it was suggested that they use condoms. I can't imagine an open-label study condom use will continue in the same fashion. We know that in cities where you see widespread use of ARVs for lowering a viral community viral load, you see a stabilization to a decline in HIV incidence, but an increase in STIs, specifically gonorrhea. So we know that patients are having more unprotected sex. They're just not transmitting HIV in those settings. This is clearly going to be one of the issues with PrEP as we start to do that. This Ken presented the same slide. I'm amazed we had so many that were different, actually. So these, to me, are what we're left with now. Sometime in the first quarter of 2012, Gilead will send in their new drug application for tenofovir and FTC. Presumably, it'll be approved sometime at the end of the first quarter, beginning of second quarter. And so then the question becomes, this will now be a legal therapy. In D.C., we can prescribe it for patients who have commercial insurance. For the most part, the commercial insurance don't realize that the patient's HIV negative. But for patients who are HIV negative and are on Medicare or on the insurance that covers three times up to the poverty level, all of those prescriptions are carve-out covered by ADAP. And since ADAP requires HIV positive, that means if you're poor or if you're three times the level of poverty, which is still mostly not rich, in the district, you're not going to get PrEP. Whereas if you have commercial insurance, you can. So the question about cost, Ken showed the cost estimates. This is going to be a very important question. At a CDC implementation meeting held, I guess, about 8 months ago, commercial insurance weren't particularly intimidated by the cost. And if you think about it, for the number of people that are going to go on PrEP compared to other costs that they've got and other medications, this is not a very high driver of costs. So commercial payers are saying, for the most part, they think they'll cover it. But however, about 70% of all HIV medications are covered by the federal government. How those programs are going to be dealt with in a Medicaid and in statewide Medicaid programs is entirely a different story. What regimen will be used? I think it will only be tenofovir FTC because that's what will probably go on label. And will daily regimens, less than daily regimens, be effective? We have to wait and see. Those, to me, are the sort of biggest hurdles leading us to my final slide, which is, well, who's going to do this? Is there anybody just, you know, leaping up to say, I'll be the one. I'd like to take care of this issue. Well, at sites that do a lot of HIV care and a lot of STDs, those sites are sort of the natural low-lying fruit for the providers that would do this. And so places that are going to be access to seronegatives that have STD clinics where there's HIV high incidence, these are going to be sites that are interested. Sites that do a lot of testing on-site or have referrals to testing are going to make it equally accessible. So community clinics that then are going to be able to provide longitudinal care. We talked about some risks of bone exposure with this. Question about renal and other things is still, I don't think we're that worried about it because in the HIV population who take it regularly, it's not that common. In all likelihood, PrEP as it's practiced probably in a year or 3 years from now is never going to be daily therapy. It's going to be some episodic-based kind of program that we'll have some data about that hasn't been presented yet. So the initial question is, where would you nest a program that would have this kind of capacity to deal with patients who'd be coming in from STD clinics, who'd be coming in from testing centers, and I think that HIV clinics give you both two things. One, they give you a group of providers that are comfortable with the medication, and they give you a large population of seronegatives. So this is really kind of an unanswered question. I use the colors, and this was a slide bar by Bob Grant that he presented at ICAC, to give you a feel for what are the sort of themes that we're going to have to find amongst providers before we can understand where the best places are. This is a very dynamic process, the issue of PrEP. We don't really know how to do it. We don't really know what regimen we're going to use, and we don't really know exactly how to identify the population. In IPREX, the definition of high risk was kind of loose. I believe it was more if you had sex with a HIV-positive person, if you had more than four partners. What was the definition, Ken? Three partners a year. So, I mean, in our clinic, that's pretty much everyone who walks in the door. So, but we're not going to offer this to everybody who walks in the door. So we're going to have to discern that a bit. And these are some of the issues that we can discuss in the Q&A. So with those sort of clinical, real, like, yeah, it sounds exciting, but it's going to be hard to figure out how to exactly do it, I'll wait to hear what Ron has to say about what policy implications this will all have. Thank you.